You're listening to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. The Ciceronian Society exists to equip and encourage Christian scholars to serve the church as a center of cultural and civic renewal. Through our events, publications, and podcasts, we provide the space and opportunities that Protestant, Catholic, and Orthodox scholars need for professional growth and intellectual discipleship. Since 2012, we have been building a network of friends with a love for our core themes, tradition, place, and things divine, and with a genuine commitment to the church and the life of the mind. To learn more about us, our events, this podcast, our journal, Pietas, to sign up for our newsletter, and make your tax-deductible gift, please go to ciceroniansociety.org. I'm Josh Bowman, Executive Director of the Ciceronian Society, and before we get started, please join me in prayer. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, we pray, O Lord, that you would bless our conversation, and that all we say and do would bring glory and honor to you. Amen.
Amen.
Today I have the joy of speaking with my very good friend, John D. Wilsey. However, I should preface the rest of this conversation and explain that while I say friend, he's really like an older brother to me, and anyone who has been in the same room as John and I knows we like to give each other a hard time, because we both deserve it. Anyway, he has a comically long bio, but here's the quickish version, and I'm going to do this because I actually think, you know, having read the book we're going to talk about, I think your life is an important context for what's going on here. John is a Georgian native living with his wife and kids in Louisville, Kentucky, or Louisville, depending on who you're talking to.
That's the way you say it.
That's right. All right. But more trivially, he is a professor of church history and philosophy and chair of the Department of Church History and Historical Theology at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. Before that, he taught at Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary and in a maximum security prison where students actually do the reading. Before that, he taught elementary, middle, and high school students in history and Bible for 11 years in North Carolina and Virginia. He also has pastored Southern Baptist churches in Charlottesville, Virginia, and Spring, Texas, and he has held a stupid number of fellowships, and it seems like he's published everywhere, in popular and academic publications, and he also has a number of books and book chapters out there. His primary areas of teaching are in modern church history, history of Western thought, and American history. And today we'll be discussing the only Wilsey book I've ever finished, titled Religious Freedom, A Conservative Primer, published by William B. Erdman's Publishing, due out this year, April 24th, 2025. John, how'd you like that introduction?
Josh, that was such a generous introduction. I'm just glad that you didn't say any of the bad stuff.
Oh, so. Well, I mean, that may be coming. We'll put that in the show notes. I am glad you're here. Now, a lot of this book retraces familiar ground and recounts some key thinkers and ideas that are foundational for Western civilization and for the American social, political, and religious tradition. I don't want to spend too much time on that, a lot of familiar ground. I want to get to what I see as your very particular contribution and what I think is a very unique way of looking at conservatism itself. But first, I want to ask this, because I think this is an important piece of what's going on here. What provoked you specifically to write this book?
Well, Josh, let me just preface by saying thank you for the invitation. I really appreciate it. It's great to be on the podcast with you. I love the Ciceronian Society. And I think we met for the first time way back in 2015, back at Mount St. Mary's when we used to meet there.
We did. True story.
And I'm very grateful that you invited me to be on the podcast. Also, I should say I'm struggling with a little bit of a cough, so I may cough from time to time here. But to answer your question, this book started out its life back in 2011 when I wanted to put together like a reader, an anthology of primary source documents in religious freedom, going back to Thomas Helwys with his short Declaration of the Mystery of Iniquity that he wrote in 1609 or something like that. And the reader was going to sort of carry along the history of religious freedom through those primary source documents all the way through. I think my last reading was in was with the Manhattan Declaration. So, and it was great. I still have the reader is still in a three-ring binder in my office at home.
Good but for I wrote, someone.
Yeah. You know, I wrote introductions to all of the readings. There were about, I don't know, 20, 25 readings, and it was a pretty big project. I couldn't find anybody that was interested in it. And so in 20, maybe 2019 or sometime in there, when I was finishing up my biography of John Foster Dulles, I asked my editor at the time at Erdman's, David Bratt, what he thought about doing my reader. And he said, well, why don't you just write a book on the topic? So
So much
I
easier.
said, so much easier. Yeah, exactly. And I had a lot of really fruitful conversations with our mutual dear friend, Trey Dimsdale. And he was coming on around that time to this to First Liberty Institute, and in the process of founding the CRCD, the Center for Religion, Culture and Democracy. And Trey and Jordan ultimately generously brought me on to as a research fellow to support the writing of this book. And that it's a long story. It's kind of a long background story about how the book came to be, but those are the high points. So I owe a great debt to the CRCD and to my friendships with Trey and with Jordan and many others who helped me along the way, including yourself. So with conversations that we've had. Also the book is a little bit it's sort of a little bit of a summary of everything I've been thinking about for the last 15 years too. So it was a fun project to write because it is a distillation of many thoughts, many things I've been ruminating on for a long time.
Well, and I get the impression too that it was also directed at the younger generations that you have spent so much time with, both as in all the different levels of education, as for your children. It's kind of trying to say, don't forget this stuff. Now, one of the things I think is unique to you, and I don't know of anyone who's put it this way before, is your notion of aspirational conservatism. So this is on page 32 of my copy. It says, I'm going to read this quote here because I think it's important. And this sort of conservatism is not only dispositional, it is aspirational. No conservative is a true conservative. All conservatives are aspiring to conserve civilization, and since such a goal is never finally attainable, there will always be intramural debates among those on the right over who the true conservatives are. I've certainly been a part of all those. As John, argues that all conservatives are on the path to true conservatism, although none of us will ever truly get there. We aspire to true conservatism, in that we aspire to guard, extend, and hand down the best of Western and American civilization to our children. The kind of conservatism I want to espouse, I call aspirational conservatism, and aspirational conservatives are committed to the effort of conserving the harmony between the spirit of liberty and the spirit of religion for the long haul. And I'm wondering if you could just elaborate, why focus on that aspirational aspect, and then maybe just get a brief summary of what you mean by those two spirits.
Well, thank you for pointing that out. That's one of the most important ideas of the book, I think. In thinking about conservatism, I've been a conservative all my life, ever since I was, ever since I can remember. My grandfather was my greatest influence, and he was a great Southern conservative. And one thing I've noticed in all these years of just paying attention to conservatives and how they talk to one another, conservatives are always at war with one another. I remember in 1992, which was the year I graduated from college, when Pat Buchanan was running against George Bush for the in the primaries. And I at the time, I wasn't paying attention all that much, and I wasn't someone really interested in political theory at the time, and I was confused as to why is Pat Buchanan saying all these horrible things about a fellow conservative? And then, of course, a few years ago, Matthew Continetti wrote his book, The Right, which his subtitle is The 100-Year War. He describes it right there in his subtitle as a war. And it occurred to me that conservatives are very interested in purity. Purity of belief, purity of doctrine, purity of ideology. But then on the other hand, we hear people like Russell Kirk say that Conservatism is not an ideology. It's a disposition. And if it's a disposition, then it seems to me that wars among conservatives are a little misplaced. Also, I hope we get, I'm sure we'll get to talk about Peter Burick some in our conversation. And since you studied under Klaus Rinne, you know all about Burick. But Burick was sort of drummed out of the conservative movement in the 1950s because he supported Adlai Stevenson. And it didn't seem to matter to his rivals that he had conservative reasons for supporting Adlai Stevenson. And he actually had a conservative view towards how to reform the New Deal. But all that his detractors could see was this one-dimensional side of him, and not sort of listen to his explanations as to why he supported Adlai Stevenson and cautiously advocated for the New Deal. He just said, oh, that's enough for us. He's not a real conservative. Frank Meyer said that he was a counterfeit, like a wolf in sheep's clothing, which I point out in the book, I think is a little bit rich coming from him, since he, well, you were a communist. So it takes one to know one, buddy. But anyway, it made me think, what if conservatism is a disposition, that seems like a moral category, not necessarily, primarily at least a philosophical one. And I'm not trying to subjectivize conservatism, but I am saying that conservatism does have strong moral virtue element to it. And if that's true, then we are all aspiring to be more virtuous. And the effort that conservatives engage in, the great effort of conserving the best of Western civilization to hand it down to our children, that's not a scientific enterprise. That's not the product of deductive problem solving. It's a stewardship. It's a cultivation. And some of us are going to be better at it than others, and we're all learning how to do that well and do it faithfully. And we're all sort of on the path to sifting what traditions are worthy of keeping and what traditions maybe are either impractical or maybe even immoral. So all that to say that conservatives, I think, because of who we are and because I agree that it's a disposition, that's why I say that none of us are true conservatives, although a true conservative disposition is that to which we aspire. In a similar way that a Christian would say, I aspire to being a disciple of Christ. I'll always fail at that, and but that's what I aspire to. So I hope that that's helpful.
It is, and I think a couple of things come to mind. The whole war for conservatism that Continetti described, it reminded me of the whole on the left, right in the late 19th century. You get the International, you get Marx, Bakunin, and all the fight for the true communists and socialists. It's a very similar
Very similar.
dynamic on the right, where it's trying to reach for that pure coherent ideology, and it's just not a real thing. And if anything, it ends up being self-defeating because the world just doesn't, conform to your ideology. And Russell Kirk, who plays a big role in this book, is behind the scenes here. He's someone who emphasizes that. And one of the things I recognize in what you're doing here is, Kirk would say that the great virtue of conservatism that's kind of underlying all of it is humility. The great vice of conservatism would be selfishness. The great vice of the left would be envy, and I don't think he gave it any virtues, but I think that aspect of being aspirational is a way of living out that humility in that sense. It's a way of emphasizing the non-ideological, humble, historically minded way of thinking about conservatism.
I like the way you said that. And one other thing I'll say about it is that the book is meant to underscore this that this idea of the two spirits, spirit of religion and spirit of liberty. But it's also meant to be intentionally and very focused on patriotism, well understood, a love for America and the American tradition and the American character. And Americans have always been an aspirational people. So to be an aspirational conservative is eminently American, and that's good.
We could get to that. That particular chapter here in a minute. I really wanted to, as you mentioned him already, Peter Viereck. So you, with this aspirational aspect, you give us examples of different streams of that aspirational conservatism. Russell Kirk, very well known, I think, in our among our audience, very widely read and deservedly so. If you don't know who Russell Kirk is, please go and read him. A lot of great places to start there. The Conservative Mind being his most famous book. He also wrote lots of fiction. That's kind of where he really got popular at one point, writing horror stuff, which is interesting. John and I have both been fellows at the Russell Kirk Center up in Mecosta, Michigan, a wonderful place. A lot of great friends there. But Peter Viereck is someone that even among conservatives who have long been in the in among the movement or an intellectual conservative, they have no idea who he is, which is unfortunate. So I give us the quick version of who he was, and what he means by an Attentatist.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite things he says. Peter Viereck was born in 1916, and he died fairly recently, 2006. He was a professor, historian at Mount Holyoke College in Massachusetts. He got there in 1948, and he taught there for 50 years. He got his PhD at Harvard. He wrote his dissertation on sort of an intellectual history of Nazism, and he saw Nazism as a political theory that sprang out of German Romanticism, especially the Romanticism of Richard Wagner. And he wrote several works on conservatism. He has his earliest book on conservatism was called Conservatism Revisited, which I think he wrote in 1949, and he also wrote a book called Conservatism from John Adams to Churchill. I think he wrote that in 1956. And he was also a poet. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 1949 for a collection of poems that he wrote under the title Terror and Decorum. So he was a real interesting person. His students at Mount Holyoke loved him. He was very popular at the school. I've talked to George Nash about Peter Viereck. He was friends with Peter Viereck, and I've talked to Lisa Bradford, who was a student of Viereck's when she was an undergraduate there in the 80s. And Lisa's writing a biography of Viereck.
That's
And
great.
then I talked to my old freshman advisor from college, where I went to school at Furman University, who was a student of Viereck's back in the 60s. And they all talk about his eccentricities, that he was popular not because he was the cool, professor. He was the weird, weird professor. He was absent-minded, and he was quirky and everything. But the students loved him. And when you read his writings, you can see why. He was such an eloquent prose writer. His poetry, I'm not a literary critic. I mean, I can read poetry, but sometimes it's a little bit of a mystery to me. But I find him to be just a beautiful writer of history and a writer of prose. He can really turn a phrase, and that Attentat term he coins is an example of that. An Attentat is a sort of European style conservative, ultra royalist, reactionary, and the type of conservative that resists change as a category. So Attentat is a word that he coined from the Italian word attentato, which means 88 in Italian. And he tells the story of the king of Piedmont, Sardinia, in the 1820s and 30s, that would go around muttering, "Attentato, attentato," because he was a royalist. He was a loyalist of the Bourbon House, and he wished that we could just go back to 1788, when, and if we could, then everything would be okay. And so he contrasts Attentats with the Burkean tradition of conservatism since the 1792, and also the conservatism in America of John Adams, who he kind of locates as the first true American conservative. So I highly recommend Viereck's writings. He's greatly edifying to read for conservatives, and also for those who maybe wouldn't say they're conservatives but are interested in the history of conservatism.
Yeah, he's overlooked. One of the things I was just thinking of, you mentioned his dissertation. He was an advisor on a documentary that came out in 1989, directed by Peter Cohen. It was called The Architecture of Doom, and it goes through what you just said, basically, understanding the Nazis as a product of German Romanticism, but also as a product of kind of a warped, immoral imagination, just with a warped aesthetic. I mean, it wasn't just Wagner; it was a lot of artists that he and I and. If you've never seen that documentary, I cannot recommend it highly enough. It's disturbing. It was
I haven't
very,
seen it. I need to see it.
yeah, it's absolutely worth your time. And it really shaped my understanding of the imagination and what the power that it had. I should write something on that someday because the documentary was absolutely brilliant. Another and I also just we don't have time here today to talk about it, but his concept of the unadjusted man, I think, is also a really a key piece to this. Another overlooked piece of this that I was not familiar with at all, to my embarrassment, frankly, is the black conservative tradition that you brought up. You mentioned folks like I had never heard of Jupiter Hammond. I assume I say that right. Or more recently, I've heard of Robert Woodson and Thomas Sowell. But you also mentioned Anne Wortham, Zora Hurston. I've heard of Glenn Lowry, Starr Parker. What distinguishes that tradition, that part of the conservative tradition for you?
Yeah, I got interested in black conservatism after I think I was introduced to the black conservative tradition through a book written by Lee Walker, who wrote a book. I think it's called Rediscovering Black Conservatism, I believe is the title. And in that book, he it's just a very clear book about sort of describing what black conservatism is. And I didn't really, I'd never really considered black conservatism as something of a category, distinct from, white conservatism. You're a conservative, you're a conservative. But I found after reading Lee Walker and after reading people like Zora Neale Hurston, Frederick Douglass, certainly Booker T. Washington, there's a great biography, a new biography called Up From History of that Rachel Ferguson put me on to a few years back on Booker T. Washington, which is very good. But what I found was that conservative thought that comes from the African American community is, as so many things in their intellectual history, is directly rooted in the experience of slavery and Jim Crow, in a way that whites who are conservatives, that's obviously not our experience. And what's so striking about black conservatism is that it's not unlike on the left. There's no cynicism about America. There's no cynicism or bitterness or resentment towards Western civilization. There's no talk of, these things being inherently racist and therefore degenerate. Actually, black conservatives uphold Western civilization, uphold American civilization. Frederick Douglass went through a change in his life where, at first, in his early in his when he was younger, he sympathized with William Lloyd Garrison, who, saw the Constitution as a deal with the devil. But then they would part ways over that issue. Garrison never really repented of that notion until maybe after the Civil War. I don't know if he ever really did. But Frederick Douglass saw the Constitution as being a pro-freedom document. In fact, the answer to the problem of slavery was the Constitution. So he was something of an American exceptionalist, if you will. So I found that interesting about Black conservatives, that they loved and sought to venerate Western and American civilization and tradition as being the brightest hope for political and social and economic equality for a people that had been oppressed for so long. And I didn't get to spend as much time on Black conservative tradition in the book as I wanted to, but I did want to introduce it at least, and I did so in the first chapter of the book.
And I think it's a great topic for, if you're listening to this, you're thinking about future conferences, that'd be a great panel topic. There'd be a lot of people who would like to listen to papers on these individuals that Whit Wilsey names here. I actually kind of want to jump ahead because one of the aspects about that kind of joins all these different conservatisms, all aspiring in some way. And I want to go back to that nationality piece if we have time. But toward the end, you talk about conservatism and religion. This book is called Religious Freedom, a Conservative Primer, or Primer, however you say it, primer, primer. I guess since I own firearms, I think of primer with the, never mind. So conservatism and religion, we get a lot of Tocqueville here. There's a lot of Tocqueville throughout the book, even when you're not talking about him. That kind of inspires a way to think through what distinguishes conservatism's relationship with religion. And I just wonder if you could elaborate a little on that.
Yes, and so I will say that Tocqueville does play a starring role in the book. I frame the book around a statement that he makes in Democracy in America, where he observed that while his own countrymen in France were unable to maintain a harmony between what he called the spirit of religion and the spirit of liberty, in America, that they have maintained that harmony. And of course, he's writing Democracy in America as a his audience is a French audience. He wants the French to be able to see what's happening in America and take what lessons can be learned that they can apply to their own situation. And I think one of the lessons he wants his audience to learn is that to have real liberty, to have true freedom, religion is necessary for true freedom to take root and flourish in a society. On page 188 of my copy here, I have a few sort of sample quotes from Tocqueville, in which he talks about religion's influence on society when it sort of becomes loses its sort of transcendent quality, when religion itself becomes a political sort of football. So if what he observed in his day was that preachers, ministers, clergymen did not bring politics into their preaching, and as a result, religion sort of stayed above the political squabbles of the day. But if religion ever does become, a political, sort of tainted with political, interests, or tied too closely to political interests, then people will reject it, and that will be bad for liberty. That's when the stage is set for a democratic despotism. But
Well,
liberty,
and
I'm
I like what
sorry.
you say here. Yeah, on page 186, just to kind of frame that, you say despotism can do without, this is a Tocqueville quote, despotism can do without faith, but not liberty, which is so good. And then the next page, this is another quote kind of getting at what you're saying. You write, in any alliance of religion and politics, politics loses nothing and religion loses everything. That is, religion loses its credibility and influence in society because it becomes too closely associated with fleeting political trends of the day. Yeah, that's page 187. Yeah.
For Tocqueville, liberty is a moral category. Liberty is not just doing whatever you want. Liberty has to be defined by moral law and civil law that's rooted in justice. And when it is, then it's always going to be religion that sort of puts, sort of defines what the standards of ethics are for just law, for the purposes of writing just laws into if you know, for the society. So under a liberty will flourish in a well-ordered and justly ordered society. That's where liberty flourishes. So just order has to come before liberty. Liberty does not precede a just order. And religion is going to be key in that because it's religion that defines what justice is. So in that regard, religion is necessary for liberty to flourish. And that's what Tocqueville says, and I deeply agree with him. And that chapter on conservatism and religion, it also comes from Kirk in his, early in his conservative mind. He gives, he gives a few of the sort of key presuppositions of a conservative, and the first of those is that conservatives believe in a transcendent reality. And you don't have to be a Christian to be a conservative. But you do have to believe in a transcendent reality, in a transcendent order. And we would call that God, as Thomas Aquinas would say. And we call that God. So I think that's right. I think that it's I think it's necessary for a conservative to believe in God. I don't think you have to be a Christian to be a conservative. But without a transcendent order that's defined in terms of a personal divine being who's our creator, how do we arrive at objective ideas of right and wrong? And from there, by extension, how can we arrive at liberty that does not turn into license? So that's kind of what I'm getting at in that chapter.
And I think it's unfortunately in some ways prescient. I don't really have a this is more anecdotal, but what I've noticed in the since I became even aware of a conservative movement in any intellectual sense, I've noticed a trend away from that pillar of conservatism that Russell Kirk emphasized, this belief in the transcendent order, his canons of conservatism, as he calls them. And this notion of a post-religious right, which is very unsettling, is very that movement is real and has more purchase among the intellectual and conservative right than I would have anticipated at this point, frankly.
Agreed.
I think it's even more prescient than when you started the project in 2011. The last thing I want to talk about was this chapter on conservatism and nationality, because you have a tough task here. Because on the one hand, you have those on both the right and the left who are just want to trash kind of the American political tradition. Like, it's not worth recovering, it's not worth conserving, it's failed, and so let's move on to something else. And so you have this trend on both left and the right. There's also this kind of hyper ideological nationalism that seems to move away from reality in a way, where you don't want to come down right and say, I love America, right or wrong, and it has no sins and it's perfect. On the other hand, you don't want to abandon it, right? You don't want to just set it all on fire and just start over. So, how do you navigate that particular issue, especially with your definition of patriotism?
So with regard to the term nationality, I did not come up with that term. I'm getting that term from a historian named Paul Nagel, who coined the term in the early 70s. And I find that his term really fits the current day discourse on, differences between, patriotism and nationalism, and all of the talk about Christian nationalism that we've been hearing for the last, several years in academic circles going back to 2006, and in the broader culture certainly since 2016. And if you pay attention to those discussions, you have people say, well, some people say, well, nationalism is this terrible thing. Christian nationalism, I've seen even people call it a heresy, like a Christian heresy, which that always seems strange to me, because if you believe it, if it's a heresy, then by definition you're going to go to hell if you for believing it.
Right, yeah.
I don't know that it kind of rises to that level of offense. But nevertheless, I think that nationality is a term that might bring some clarity to the discussion about, Christian nationalism, religious nationalism versus patriotism. And the reason why I think it's helpful is because Americans have always been crafting an identity for themselves ever since they, founded the colonies in the 17th century and early 18th. From the very beginning, Americans have asked themselves, who are we in relationship to God, in relationship to other peoples, other nations, and in relationship to ourselves? And the way they've answered that question over the generations has changed over time. And one thing that's common is that one of the ways that they answer that have answered that question over time is that they always include God, and they always include theological ideas in the way that they think about themselves. And that makes sense, because in our national founding, the United States is founded upon transcendent ideals, ideals that are objective and real across the generations. Things like, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their creator by certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's not just a statement that's relevant for one generation. That's a universal truth. It's a transcendent truth. So it's not surprising at all that Americans would include God and transcendent ideas and philosophy and theology in the way that they identify themselves. Now, of course, it goes off the rails when Americans have identified themselves, as the chosen people of God, or as divinely ordained to carry out a God-given mission in the world. I've said a lot about all that kind of stuff in other writings that I've done. But where I find nationality especially helpful is not only in answering the question, how do Americans come up with these ideas about themselves, but also how have Americans in the past created or envisioned a patriotism that is well ordered? And there are good examples that we can follow and bad examples that we can avoid in the past. But ultimately, patriotism, rightly ordered patriotism, places love of country in an ordering of loves in an appropriate way. And that's sort of the point of that chapter. And a conservative seeks to, again, a conservative aspires to cultivate and craft a patriotism that is rightly ordered. And sometimes we will get it wrong. Sometimes we will make mistakes, but we are aspiring to something that is good and worthy to pass down to our children and teach our children as they come along, as they grow up, and as they end up, coming of age to join the military, to sacrifice for their country, to then become active citizens who have the country's best interest in mind in their private and public life, and as they raise children of their own and raise them up to carry on a tradition that, we received from our forefathers and that we're going to pass down to our children. These are all aspirational things, and they're all concerned with the good and the true and the beautiful.
And they're all it's it there's the countercultural piece of all that is simply the nuance, which in our world of social media just doesn't translate. I mean, nuance doesn't translate to social media at all, let
No, not at
alone,
all.
you know. And so
Right.
that's, I think, so much of the if you want to call it a discourse, that seems generous.
Yeah.
Right, the public discourse, if you will, on these questions, it's just not there. And one of the reasons I think it's so important for us to have conferences like the Ciceronian Society does and other events is the only way we're going to have these nuanced conversations. I mean, we're having it here on a podcast, but even this is limited. There's so much more to this book that we could bring up and talk about, and I, you know, I, we will do so in person at some point. But yeah. John, I'm thankful for this book. I'm thankful for this opportunity. I really think you've done a great job here, and I think this notion of aspirational conservatism, I hope it gets some purchase in the conversation among intellectual conservatives, because I think it's going to be a very, very helpful tool to describe who we are going forward.
Well, thanks, Josh. That means a lot. Appreciate it.
No problem, man. Well, you've been listening to The Sower, a production of the Ciceronian Society. And if you've enjoyed this conversation, we hope you'll consider signing up for our newsletter and joining us for a future event. I don't quite know when this episode's going to go live. I'm guessing that by this point, I've announced the 2026 conference and dates. So head over to the website and see for yourself. Be sure to rate and review this podcast, share it with your friends, and check out our website at ciceroniansociety.org. And be sure to take a look. You can pre-order John's book. It is available on Amazon, on Erdman's website as well. It comes out in late April, and I definitely encourage you to get it. Now, may the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ and the love of God and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with us all evermore. Thank you for listening.